Good evening. I'm going to start slowly and get my words working in proper order here. Good to see everybody tonight. Glad you're here. Glad for those who are visiting, those who are not strangers. It's good to have you, Terry and Peggy. As Proverbs Solomon said in Proverbs, it is good to be refreshed by those that we know that we haven't seen in a while, so that's a wonderful thing. We're going to have a few things to say, just a couple points about the end of John chapter 2, finishing up the context about Jesus cleansing the temple, and then we will move on to John chapter 3, and we're going to talk about Nicodemus. And I just told Mick, for some reason, studying Acts chapter 2 on Sundays, I don't know why I keep wanting to replace Cornelius with Nicodemus. They don't start the same, but they, I don't know. So if I do that, just in my mind for the last 2 weeks, I've been thinking about John chapter 3, and in my mind I keep popping Cornelius up, and that's not going to work. So we'll talk about Nicodemus in John chapter 3. All right, John chapter 2, in the context beginning of verse 13, the last couple weeks, we've talked about Jesus. When he came to the city of Jerusalem, he went into the temple, and what he found there was sellers of merchandise, people selling oxen and sheep and doves to be used for sacrifices. They were selling those in what portion of the temple, Jonathan?
The Gentile.
Court of the Gentiles. Again, which was just outside where the primary temple structure was. And when Jesus came in and saw that, his reaction was swift. It was stern, if you will. And his response to those who were in the temple selling these things, and not only the sellers of oxen, sheep, and doves for the purpose of sacrifice, but there was also people engaged in what?
Merchandising,
but the exchanging of money, because people had come from all over the known world. Again, as you go to a foreign country, you need to change your currency, and they were doing that, but doing it for a profit. And Jesus' response to these people who were merchandising was what?
Turning
my house, my father's house, into a place of business. And we talked about the fact that, again, they had turned it into a place of profit. We talked about the fact that they had compromised the purpose for which they had come together. We talked about the fact that, obviously, those who needed to offer sacrifices at the Passover, indeed, was it what they were doing in the temple that was wrong, in the court of the Gentiles? I mean, is selling sheep and oxen wrong in and of itself?
No,
but it was the fact of where they were doing it. They were compromising the purpose for what that place was and what it was meant for, which was a place of worship, of prayer, and of study. And so Jesus condemned them for turning his father's house into a house of merchandise, a house of gain. And we talked about last week that when he said that, what did it trigger in the mind of his disciples? I'm sorry?
Question. That question, it remembered later about the passage that said, zeal for your household consuming.
Okay, so it triggered their memory of the Old Testament scriptures, and it's kind of like one of those, oh yeah, remember what it said in the old law. And again, they connected two and two, and they said, remember this passage in the old law, and remember what we just saw. We saw the Lord's zeal for his father's house and what it caused him to do. And we talked about his disciples and how that at the end of his life and then after his resurrection, how that Jesus helped them remember the things that were written about him in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms about him. And so he helped them in terms of the memory, the things that they needed to remember that was said about him in the law. And in fact, then in verse 22 of John chapter 2, when therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. So again, all these things came to pass. And again, what was it that Jesus said in response to the request for a sign? Again, the sign, remember we talked about that last week, they wanted to say, you came in here and did this in the temple. In essence, their question was, by whose authority? And in order to show us you have authority to do this, show us a sign. And Jesus' response was,
destroy this temple in 3 days and I will raise it up.
All right. So again, he says, the sign will be given to you, but it, yeah. And the example of my grandpa is like, not now. You'll get the sign later. And will it be a powerful example? Will it be a powerful sign? Again, it'll be the sign, as we read in Romans chapter 1, verse 4, that proved that Jesus indeed was the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so we see the sign that he gave, and again, it said there in verse 22, when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered. They remember these things. Now, verse 23 through the end of the chapter, it says, now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name, beholding his signs which he was doing. So we've talked about the fact that what sign did we earlier study in John chapter 2? Turning the water to wine. And again, did that sign cause belief? At least in his disciples and the few people who actually knew what transpired. But now at the Passover, he's doing more what? More signs. Again, it says, and it's not the singular, but it says the plural there in verse 23. Beholding his signs which he was doing. And so, do we know what those signs were? No. But again, what's the definition of the word sign?
Defining characteristic,
a distinguishing mark, as it were. And so again, whatever it was a defining and distinguishing act that separated him from anybody else. And so he was doing other signs. And again, the other Gospels use the word miracles. But he was doing miracles, therefore, at the Passover. And those miracles, according to verse 23, created belief, created faith in who he is, and that he was the Son of God. Now, also, just like today, those who observed his signs were there some genuine believers. Sure. And whenever the truth is presented, will that truth, whether it be the preaching of the gospel, the presentation of signs, will it appeal to the good and honest heart? But are there also people who sometimes feign belief? As it were, will pretend to be believers for whatever reason. But what does verse 24 say regarding those who saw these signs? It says, but Jesus on his part was not entrusting himself to them, for he knew all men, and because he did not need anything to bear witness concerning man, for he himself knew what was in man. So again, it says Jesus on his part was not entrusting himself to them. Why? I'm sorry? Right. So it just said there are many who believe, but he says, he wasn't entrusting himself to everybody because he knew what was in their heart. And were there some who professed to be disciples of Jesus Christ for other motives, for other reasons? And would that ever fool Jesus Christ in terms of those who would claim allegiance to him?
He knows their hearts.
And what did Jesus say in Luke chapter 6, verse 46?
I call him me Lord, Lord.
Were there people who called him Lord and then didn't do what he said? So we see here, again, at the Passover, he's performing signs. There's people who no doubt genuinely believe, but Jesus says, but John records he wasn't entrusting himself to everyone. He knew that in some people's hearts, that their expression of faith may not be genuine. Peyton?
Well, Jesus knew that Judas was the one that was going to betray him.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He knows what's in the hearts of men. And he knew that there may have been some at the Passover at that time. Lord, those are wonderful signs. But knowing in their hearts, they really weren't believers. And they perhaps already were plotting against him. Do you think there were some, again,
who saw what he did in the temple. And perhaps we're not happy about that. And perhaps we're stirred up in terms of their animosity against Jesus, who maybe would have feigned at that time. Oh, Jesus is a wonderful miracle. But in their hearts, they're so angry about what he did.
Well, the Jews were very threatened by
yes,
Jesus
they were.
And everything that he did. I mean, he shook them to their core.
Yeah, no, there were definitely people now who have seen what he did, the authority by which he cleansed the temple, the signs which he is performing. And indeed, there are those who would be threatened by this. And again, those who might then feign allegiance to him, who might offer accolades to him. Do people ever offer accolades and praise to men today and not really mean it? Absolutely. Do we always know when people are doing that to us? No, we don't. Sometimes maybe we do. Some people are good at feigning accolades. Did it fool Jesus at all? It did not. He understood. He understood, I can't entrust myself to everyone who comes to me with praise. I can't trust myself to everybody who comes with accolades to me because I know what's in their hearts. And he didn't need anybody, verse 25, to bear witness concerning man. So, we leave Jesus at the Passover. He's performed signs, he's cleansed the temple. Many believe. Many are feigning faith in him. Many are offering accolades and praise unto him, but don't really mean it.
I was just going to mention over at Luke, you know, Luke is telling the story in order. I just wanted to see, just curiosity, what were the very first signs listed in Luke? And what I see is that in Luke chapter 4, verse 33, in the synagogue, there was a man possessed by the spirit of an unclean demon. They cried out with a loud voice, "Let us alone. What business do we have to do with each other? Jesus of Nazareth, have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be quiet and come out of him." And when the demon had thrown him down in the midst of the people, he came out of it without doing any harm. Jumping over to verse 40, it says, "While the sun was setting, all those who had any who were sick with various diseases brought them to him, laying his hands on each of them, he was healing them. Demons were also coming out, many shouting, 'You are the Son of God,' but rebuking them, he did not allow them to speak, because he knew him to be Christ." I was thinking that I think when it talks about the observing the signs which he was doing, I'm just maybe concluding from the fact that Luke mentions that casting out demons and healing the sick were awesome signs. The only reason it's important is because there in verse 2 of chapter 3, it goes right back into, we know that you do signs. Well, he must have been known for these signs. If he was in the synagogue when he cast out demons, that was in front of a lot of people.
Right, right. So know that again, that's the whole purpose. John wrote the Gospel of John, that we might believe, that we might behold the signs that he did. And certainly John records at the end of his Gospel that we only are given a snippet of what he did. And when it said there in verse 23 that they beheld his signs, we have no idea how many or what type. Again, whether it was healing, whether it was, again, casting out demons. We don't know what they were, but they were signs. And they were signs that caused people to believe. And there were so many of them that John says, we can't even write these down. We can't even record all of them that happened. And so you just have a little statement here by John that says, they beheld his signs, and they believed. And, okay?
Just say, I have a reference to that in John 11:45.
All right.
It says, "Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.' But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish.
Right. So again, we see the varied reaction to the signs. We see, and again, that's what in presenting the gospel, or in the signs that are performed, you see varied reaction. People saw Lazarus raised from the dead. Some people believed. Other people what?
Wanted to kill him.
So, again, remember what was told to Mary and Joseph by Simeon? That their son would be appointed for the rise and fall of many in Jerusalem. That many, again, because of their belief, it would be a source of eternal life. For those who would stumble over him, Jesus performing the same miracles in front of the same people, it would be a source of stumbling. And again, we see that throughout the scriptures, as Peggy has pointed out. Any other comments then about John chapter 2, about the cleansing of the temple and the reaction thereof? All right, so let's go on to John chapter 3. Looking forward to talking about Jesus and Nicodemus. And maybe we'll throw Cornelius in there somewhere too. Mickey's already prepared with one similarity between the two accounts. So. John chapter 3, let's go ahead and read. How far do we want to go down? Let's just read 1 through 9 of John chapter 3, if I can get someone to volunteer for that. Jenny?
Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Jesus answered him, Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Nicodemus said to him, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? Jesus answered, Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I said to you, You must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. Nicodemus said to him, How can these things be?
All right, thank you. So we see an entirely new context here. It's after the situation of the Passover. We don't know how much time has gone by, but it simply says in verse 1 of chapter 3, Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus. So, who is Nicodemus? What do we know about him from this context?
He's a ruler of the Jews.
He's a ruler of the Jews. Interestingly enough, who was it during the end of Christ's ministry upon earth that led the charge to put Jesus to death? The rulers of the Jews. He was part of the group that ultimately was responsible for putting Jesus to death. So put that into context a little bit in terms of who his peers are, who his colleagues are, the people that are like him. He's of that group that put Jesus to death. The ruler of the Jews, what's the body that we commonly refer to as the ruler of the Jews? It's the Sanhedrin court or council. They were the ruling body of the Jews. They were the ones who had the authority at that time. The people looked up to them. So he was a ruler of the Jews. He was a Pharisee of the Sanhedrin council. Let me ask this about Nicodemus. What was the primary factor that enabled Nicodemus to be a ruler of the Jews, part of the Sanhedrin Council, a Pharisee? What's the foremost qualification? What I'm looking for is, could a Gentile... So you had to be a Jew, which meant the most important thing was who your parents were. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
And to be part of the Sanhedrin council did to be a Jew and to be born to a lowly family in Jewish society at that time, did that entitle you to become part of the Sanhedrin council? Your lineage meant a lot, did it not? And for those who were part of the rulers of the Jews, perhaps the most important thing of your life was the fact of your birth, was it not? Who you were born to, whose mom and dad, what was your upbringing? What did that birth then entitle you to?
And I find it kind of interesting because we all know what Jesus is about to tell this man. But up until this point in time, a ruler of the Jews, a Pharisee of the Sanhedrin Council, his physical birth meant a lot to him. That was very important to him or to her. But to a ruler of the Jews, to him. Mickey?
I thought you were fishing for something else. As this man is described in verse 10, I believe it is, as a teacher of Israel. In order to be a part of the Sanhedrin court, of course, that was what we would call the Supreme Court of the Jews. He would have to make a law, which turned out to be his advantage.
Yes, and so that's an important aspect of that. But he was to be a teacher of law, and to, you know, if you look to, I think it is it Malachi that talks about that the priests, you know, were to be the correctors of those, as in chapter 2 on the right hand page, right hand column up near the top.
The law from the mouth.
Right. And but even more so, should they not, you know, from a Pharisee who's on the Sanhedrin Council, who's a ruler of the Jews, should he not be a guider, you know, of the Jews at that time? And in fact, though, what do we know about the Pharisees and what was important to the Pharisees, who again were looked up to at that time? What was important to them? Ready?
According to Matthew 23, what was important to them was that everything looked good.
Okay, so thank you. It was about the physical. I mean, the Pharisees took a very physical approach to things, didn't they? And in terms of the Messiah and the kingdom to come, what was their whole mindset about, you know, about the Messiah, about the kingdom?
That they were going to overthrow
the Roman Empire. Yeah, again, physical, right? What they were needing. And in terms of righteousness before God, their whole approach to righteousness and the law was physical. It was fleshly. It was again, outward cleansing. And in terms of they should have been teachers, they were to know the law, to teach it. But in fact, what were the Pharisees known for actually teaching? The written word? The oral traditions. And again, one of the things that defined the Pharisees, as opposed to even the Sadducees, we talked about what the Pharisees believed in the resurrection, the Sadducees didn't. The Sadducees tended to believe in the written word. The Pharisees believed in the oral law. And what carried the most weight amongst, you know, the Pharisees is what had orally been passed down from generation to generation. And do you remember, and I find this fascinating when you read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, because what did Jesus continually say to the scribes and Pharisees? You have heard that it was said, and therefore talk about the oral law that had been passed down from generation to generation. Notice when Jesus talked to them, he didn't say, well, you have read in the law. He says, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. And so again, when we think about the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin Council and the rulers of the Jews, and we will see that throughout the life of Christ many, many, many times where they were concerned about their traditions, about orally what had been passed on, that you do this before you eat, you do this to, again, present yourself before others. So this is part of who the Pharisees were. They were to be the teachers of the law, but what they imparted most of all was oral traditions. And Nicodemus is one of those rulers of the Jews. And again, as
as a ruler of the Jews, did he have to be like everybody else? And indeed, did Nicodemus turn out to be like everybody else?
No.
No, he did not. You know, is it possible to come out from among them and be separate? And in fact, as we study, I think the life of Nicodemus is a very interesting three-point sermon. It's a fascinating transition that we see Nicodemus make in his life. Juan?
So, I know sometimes people will say that Jesus doesn't talk about baptism directly because that doesn't come until later, but is this, when he speaks of the water, is that kind of alluding to that? Like, a lot of people will say he never said to be baptized, it was only the apostles after his death said to be baptized. So, is this alluding to that?
Yes. In a word, yes. He absolutely is talking about baptism. When we get down to talking about his answer, when he talks about being born of the water and the Spirit, he absolutely is talking about baptism. And did Jesus ever talk about baptism any other time? Yeah, he did. And certainly in the Great Commission. But no, and we'll get there. But you're absolutely on point. He is talking about baptism here. As we get down to that. So who is Nicodemus? Again, he's a ruler of the Jews. He's part of the Sanhedrin Council. Again, what entitled Nicodemus as a Jew to be a ruler? Again, it was his birth. Did to the Jews, did their heritage mean a lot to them? Who they were born to? Remember what they said to Jesus? Who is our father? Again, it mattered to them who they were born, you know, who they're born to. Yeah, who their parents were, and lineage meant a great deal to them. And would it have meant anything to Nicodemus as a ruler of the Jews? Yes, it did. Terry?
Apparently, an important Saul of Tarsus described himself as a Hebrew of Hebrews, studied at the feet of Gamaliel.
Yes.
There we see there that even it was even important where they got their education from.
Any different today?
It's just like today, isn't it?
Yeah. It matters, again. Does it matter today, you know, who your parents are and who you're born to and what advantages, you know, your parents give to you in terms of education and teaching and experiences and, you know, being born into families that own great businesses and so forth? You know, we were at home reading from, you know, Ecclesiastes, you know, chapter 1 and 2, talking about, you know, working so hard to, you know, to build up a great business, and then you die, Solomon says, and you leave it to someone else. Again, sometimes children grow up in families where they're very blessed by who their parents are. And no doubt you're right, Saul was a great example of that. So just talking about the fact, kind of setting the stage, because we know what Jesus' answer was, but to folks like Nicodemus, again, their physical birth meant a whole lot. It meant a whole lot. Hey?
In the Jewish religion, who a Jew's mother is really important, more so than who their father might be. If we look at Jesus' lineage, Rahab is a very important part of that.
Right. Yeah, the lineage is critical. It meant a whole lot, and perhaps in today's society here in America, we don't perhaps fully understand that. You know, we care about who our parents are and so forth, but you know, again, it's not nearly what it used to be. So when we think about Jesus and Nicodemus, Nicodemus was referenced two other times in the book of John. If somebody can turn to John chapter 7 and read verses 45 through 52 for me. John chapter 7, 45 through 52. Randy?
John 7, 45 through 52. The officers then came to the chief priests and Pharisees and said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" The officers answered, "Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks." The Pharisees then answered him, "You have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this crowd, which does not know the law, is accursed. Nicodemus, he who came to him before, being one of them, said to them, Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it? They answered him, You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet rises out of Galilee.
All right, so again, we see in verse 45, again, the officers came to the chief priest. They had not brought Jesus back with them. The officers were saying, nobody's ever taught like Jesus, like this man has. Again, the Pharisees accuse him of being led astray. You're getting deceived by this man. And then points out, and again, establishes the point, was there peer pressure amongst the Pharisees and the rulers of the Jews? You see there in verse 48, here's the company line. Here's the company line. If you're one of us, you don't believe in him. Does everybody understand that? I mean, that's the peer pressure. If no one, he says again, verse 48, no one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? Again, there's the statement. If you're one of the rulers, you're one of the Pharisees, you're, in essence, it's a statement, you're not to be a believer in him. You know, they put it in the form of a question, like, you know, none of us have become believers in him. And then we read again here of Nicodemus. And at this point in the life of Nicodemus, what does he say now?
He's trying to make a just statement.
Okay.
Says, our law does not judge a man unless he first hears from him. He knows what he's doing, does it?
Okay.
He poses a question as well.
A defense of Jesus a little bit?
You're not going to judge this man before you hear him, are you?
Yeah. Okay. So again, he speaks up on behalf of Jesus in terms of, again, basically saying, should we not listen to him? Should we not hear what he has to say? And again, it's a good point. A lot of these rulers of the Pharisees, rulers of the Jews, had even bothered to take time to actually hear what he had to say? Probably not. Vicki?
I find it interesting, again, that Nicodemus knows the law.
Yes.
This is a judicial body. And Nicodemus reminds them of what their responsibility is. The law said, at the mouth of two or three witnesses, man would be put to death. Well, we've got to hear what he says and allow the man who is accused to confront his accusers. That's what the law says.
And he's right. Absolutely. So, do we see him necessarily openly proclaiming, I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God here? But he's at least stating, again, according to law, we need to listen to him. We need to hear what he has to say before we make a judgment. So that's the second reference. And I put up there again John chapter 11, and Peggy, you read from that context earlier, because in that context, in terms of let's hear from him first, as Peggy read from that context of John chapter 11, verses 47 through 53, had they been paying attention to what he had been doing? Because as Peggy had read in verse 48, they said, if we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. Did they know what he was doing? Yeah, they did. And they knew what the effect was. And as had been pointed out earlier, again, they saw their power slipping away, and they said, if we let him go on like this. So it's interesting again that Nicodemus reminds them, yeah, we need to hear from him first. But they knew about what he was doing, and they knew the persuasion his signs were having amongst the Jews that day. All right, so that's the second reference to Nicodemus, first here in John 3, then John 7, and then again in John chapter 19. So let's turn to John chapter 19, if I can get someone to read 38 through 40. John chapter 19, 38 through 40. Thank you, Lori.
John chapter 19, 38 through 40. After his name, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate if he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate granted permission, so he came and took away his body. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews.
All right, so we think, and we see here in verses 38 through 40, after his crucifixion, we read of a man named Joseph of Arimathea being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one, again for fear of the Jews. Asked Pilate that he might take the body of Jesus away. Pilate granted permission. And again, who is with Joseph of Arimathea then as they take the body of Jesus and give it the proper burial? We have Nicodemus. So again, we see the third reference of Nicodemus with Joseph of Arimathea. Now, after the crucifixion of Christ, comes before Pilate and says, we want the body of Jesus so that we can, again, give him a burial. John chapter 3, he came to him by night. John chapter 7, he gives a defense of Jesus in terms of, let's hear him out. What do we see from Nicodemus here in John chapter 19? In that situation, when Jesus had just been put to death by a mob that had been stirred up against Jesus, and no doubt against anybody else who would claim allegiance to him, for Joseph and Nicodemus to come to Pilate and says, we want his body. How bold of a statement was that?
And if you look over in Luke, chapter 23 and 50, it says that Joseph was also a member of the council. So he and Nicodemus were both believers on the council, but for fear of the Jews or the other rulers, they did not openly confess.
All right. So, again, no doubt Joseph and Nicodemus, this was not their first meeting, that they knew each other. But I want us to appreciate it. In all my own life, I've known that it was Nicodemus and Joseph Arimathea who came to get the body of Jesus. And we're like, well, that was a good thing. That was a courageous thing.
Dangerous thing.
That was a bold thing. That was professing their allegiance to Jesus Christ. In front of who? Everyone. I'm sorry, what did you say? Yeah, in front of Pilate, in front of the rulers, in front of everybody who had been putting him to death. Well, I mean, but they, yes, in front of Pilate at that moment. But no doubt, you know, what was it done in secret in terms of coming to take the body? Like I said, it was a public thing to do. Again, this was a public, as it were, mission, I'm with him. And an interesting aspect. So again, John chapter 3, John chapter 7, John chapter 19, we read of Nicodemus at various stages in his life, various stages in terms of his discipleship. Going back to John chapter 3, this man Nicodemus in verse 2 says he first of all, and I overlooked this when I was preparing my notes, John chapter 3 verse 2, this man what? I'm sorry?
Came to him.
And again, I think we, you know, there's importance in those words. Jesus came to him. I mean, Nicodemus came to him. He came to Jesus. And sometimes people come to Jesus today, maybe not with full conviction, maybe not with full understanding of the Word of God, but they come. And again, I stopped and thought, I need to appreciate number one that Nicodemus came. He came to Jesus. Randy?
I was just going to add to what Melissa said. John 12:42 says, nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him, for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue, and they loved the ruler, and they were the rule of God.
Yes.
Maybe the rulers. It says many, so more than just Joseph. Maybe
oh, yes, yes. Again, that's where, you know, that context in John chapter 11 in terms of, again, it, again, the company line for the rulers of the Pharisees is, we're not believers in Jesus. And if anybody, as you point out, if anybody is going to go follow after him in terms of their place in the synagogue, you're gone. And would Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea have known that when they came to take the body of Jesus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about with him coming to Jesus, the other thing to be noted is that he came to Jesus by night, but he came to Jesus not in the crowd. He came to have a conversation with Jesus, not to try and trick him, not to try and trap him, not trying to figure out what's going on. He came to actually have a conversation.
Definitely. And again, but I, you know, and we're going to talk just now, let's talk about the fact that he came to Jesus. What's the next two words? By night. Any significance about him coming to Jesus by night? Okay. What's one possibility of that phrase, he came to him by night? One possibility is he didn't want to be seen. That again, he wanted to, as Joseph of Arimathea was, he wanted to be a disciple, but he wasn't ready to be one openly. And is that a possibility? As we read everything that has been pointed out about the rulers of the Jews, knowing that, again, you'd be cast out of the synagogue. Again, knowing that it would change your life forever to be openly known as a disciple of Jesus Christ. So, possibly it could have been that he came to him by night, and there's again evidence that perhaps as a rule of the Jews, there would be a motivation not to be doing so openly. Do we know that for sure?
He might have got off work.
He might have been busy. He might have been busy.
But it might have been a better time to get Jesus involved.
Again, it's right. We don't know for sure, but there's a possibility there that the reason he came to him by night. And then we'll leave it at that. Is there a possibility that he came to him by night? Because again, he wasn't ready to be as Joseph was. He doesn't want to be openly known as a disciple of Jesus. Possibly.
Or suspected.
Or, right, even suspected.
We see in that chapter 7 that he's a reasonable man according to the law. He wants to do things according to the law. But even according to the law, we're to hear that before we judge him. So here's a case where he's being practical with that. He wants to hear what he has to say.
Right. Right. So again, but just go ahead, Carol.
It's also possible that, you know, when somebody's in a high position and they have an understanding or a sympathy or a connection with someone who is in a position that's precarious or dangerous or whatever, maybe he felt that in his position he could somehow have his ear in the council and, you know, protect quite know how to put it into words, but his high position afforded him a certain level of access. Speculation, but
his opportunity that he saw, he could have possibly seen himself as an opportunity to have his way in the council.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With that, by
especially the,
I mean, this is his first stage in knowing to figure things out. It's investigating. Mm-hmm.
Good chair.
Or at least use the word there. I think you see Nicodemus coming to Jesus because look at the statement that he makes in the second verse. We know that thou art the teacher, come from God. No one can do these signs that thou doest except God be with him, I think. And we know for instance, that Jesus made a statement about himself that everything written in the scriptures, in the prophets, for instance, about him had to be fulfilled.
Right.
We don't know how much or what extent, but Nicodemus, as we see, he understands the law. Nicodemus may have been putting some things together in terms of these signs, in terms of what was written and prophesy about the Messiah. And he has questions that he wants answered. He's driven by curiosity, perhaps curiosity that goes as far as, is, you know, are you the prophesied one, Messiah?
He stops short of calling him that here in John chapter 3, but indeed, you know, again, and that goes back to, again, by this is about the fact that he came to him. Indeed, perhaps driven by what he had seen. He had seen the signs. And again, knowing as a teacher of the law, that again, could this be that I need to check this out?
Right, because it's almost like, you know, when you use the phrase, or we need to check this out, the statement in John chapter 7 there, our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him. Beneath that, it's almost like he's saying, let's be careful here. We might be making a mistake.
Yeah. He's actually, in the John chapter 7, he's exercising caution, isn't he?
Yes.
Again, we need... And again, who also, like in the book of Acts, tried to exercise some caution about the apostles? Demanded of them, yeah.
Right. I was just on the same line as him over in chapter 7. Their answer to his statement that our law does not judge the rest of the years for the first, that is what he's doing with it, they answer him, you're not also from Galilee, are you? I mean, they're accusing him. Like, you're not one of the rabble that we're dealing with here, are you? So, I mean, they were basically insulting him. You want to defend this guy?
Yes. Yes. So again, just by the words, he came to Jesus by night. Again, there could be other reasons, but we do know that there was a lot of pressure on those who were the rulers of the Jews at that time. That indeed the other gentleman that we talked about, Joseph of Arimathea, who until the crucifixion of Christ, again, was remaining a secret disciple. You read in John chapter 7 and verse 13 that it said, yet no one was speaking openly of him for fear of the Jews. And not only not going to him, but people, again, in terms of talking about Jesus, in terms of talking about their faith in Jesus, believing the signs, people weren't speaking openly about him. Why? Because again, the fear of the Jews. And so we see that pressure upon those to not go along with that. In John chapter 9, the second I'll get to you, Bruce, what's the miracle performed in John chapter 9?
Healing of the blind man.
And the young man whose sight was restored, did he believe? And again, did he confess? But what about his parents?
So to ask him, he's of age.
And it says in John chapter 9 that they said this because what? Verse 22, they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be the Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. So again, we see the pressure of anyone, much less the rulers of the Jews, that if you confess Jesus to be the Christ, if you openly admit, speak openly of him, that you're his disciple, that you'll be cast out of the synagogue. So, next week, Lord willing, I want to begin by kind of summarizing these three contexts about Nicodemus. And indeed, we'll begin making the presumption, if indeed Nicodemus came to Jesus by night because of the fact that, again, the fear of the Jews, the fear of the reaction, that we don't know that for sure, but it's interesting. If that was the case, he came to Jesus the first time in one state. We see him then in John chapter 7. Again, now publicly defending Jesus, but cautiously so, but then you see a whole other Nicodemus in John chapter 19, who's no longer timid, if he was in the first place, no longer cautious, but taking a bold stance, you know, for Jesus Christ. And again, an encouragement, I think, for all of us in terms of where we're at with our faith right now, Do we ever find ourselves maybe a little timid, maybe a little cautious? And to see perhaps an example of Nicodemus, of someone who, if indeed he was at the beginning, grew beyond any timidity or cautiousness to become a bold and confident believer in Jesus Christ. So we'll continue in there, John chapter 3, Lord willing.